at GBQ, we're always counting. Now we're making your time count with this episode of Empower Hour. Start the clock. Today we are joined by Helen Patton, an advisory CISO at Cisco, where she shares security strategies with the security community. Previously, she spent 8 years at the Ohio State University as their CISO, and we'll explain what CISO is here in a moment. Welcome, Helen.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
So what did I miss that the audience should know about your experience in security? Well, we'll get to security, cybersecurity, information security, whatever this field is. What did I miss about your experience that was important for you, the vantage point of writing a book for people looking for work or trying to improve their work life in the security industry?
I don't think you missed much. I mean, the highlights are about that, right? So a CISO at a university, now at Cisco. So I've gone to the dark side and I'm on the vendor side of the world, which is new for me. Prior to that, I was at JP Morgan. So, you know, I've done some pretty culturally different things, I think. But what drove me to write the book originally was my time at Ohio State, because when you're surrounded by students all the time, you tend to get a lot of people, not just college students, but others who sort of reach out and say, how do I get in this industry? How do I stay in this industry? How do I start a security program for the first time? I'm getting all of those questions. And so I was blogging about it for 2 or 3 years on Medium. And I just sort of, I thought it was time for me to put it all in one place. And so So being the CISO at Ohio State was really the catalyst for that, I think.
Well, and actually blogging about it, but also I happen to know very, very active on LinkedIn. So if you're contemplating an entry into the career or just another good news feed, you have some great questions out there from time to time. I'm not sure if it's steady, but I sure notice you out there quite a bit. Most of the folks that are listening to us are not security professionals and they're not in the industry. Mm-hmm. And so we run the risk of jumping into all the jargon. What is a CISO?
So a CISO stands for Chief Information Security Officer. And I think the first named CISO probably came about, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s. But there were plenty of people running security programs before the name or the title of CISO came about. But essentially, the person who's the CISO is the most senior person in an organization who is responsible for helping the business have a security program, understand their information and technology risks. It's not just about the tech, it's about the data, and setting a strategy for an organization to move forward in a way that matches the risk appetite of the organizational culture, which is a lot to pack into 2 or 3 sentences. It is a lot of people who are not in technology think of being a chief information security officer or being a security person as being primarily a technical job. And there is certainly technical elements to being in security and being a CISO. But what we see these days is a CISO probably spends more of their time in governance, policy setting, organizational change management, awareness, those kinds of things, and much less doing hands-on technology work. Depends on the size of the company and it depends on the industry, but in general, a CISO is much more of a C-suite executive these days than they used to be. So it's a changing role as well.
And traditionally, the CISO role was in a bigger organization, a world-class university, a bank, or other organizations that had some sense of compliance requirements that would drive it. We're beginning to see the CISO being driven down, the CISO role being required in small and mid-sized businesses, startups. Right. But not only is that role being required, but all of the various kinds of people that participate on the security program. And so there's this tremendous opportunity in the field. You refer to it in the book. I'm not sure exactly how short we are. I think it changes day to day about we have this many jobs and those many people that can do those jobs, but there's tremendous opportunity in this industry.
Yeah, there is a lot of opportunity. And I would tell you that I get together with my CISO colleagues and we have arguments about whether there are truly shortages or not, or whether we just have hiring managers without enough creativity to find the right people. However, yes, there is a lot of opportunity in the cybersecurity field. And I think when I talk to students, there is a lot of demand coming up from high school and college age students to come into security than there used to be before. But they'll come to me and they'll say, Helen, I want to work in security. And I'll say, well, what do you mean by security? And they're like, what do you mean? What do I mean? So I still think there is a lot of not understanding about really what the breadth is. So, you know, I teach an undergraduate information risk class at Ohio State. I'm doing that now with a colleague. And we're not just talking about secure coding or networking. We're talking about policy. We're talking about law. We're talking about psychology. We're talking about history. We're talking about politics. And, you know, you just got to look at what's happening internationally, Russia, Ukraine, China, others, and cyber is in all of it, right? So this is actually a hugely broad field. Now, when you're in a small to medium company, the tendency is to be very tech focused, and that's appropriate. But as the company grows, as the footprint of the company grows, becomes multi-jurisdictional, you get into all of these kinds of legal questions that make this a really super broad industry. It's great. I love it.
It is a lot of fun. And you suggest this in the book, that there's not a typical career path. And we've been fortunate that some people that in my life that have worked on my team have also worked on your team. And I thought about those people. One started his career as a music teacher. One started his career as a salesperson. One, probably the most unique one of the bunch, and if you know him, you know who I'm talking about, a prison guard, and then a restaurant shift manager. And I think there may have been some others, but what a wild collection of starting points. And I think that's fairly true for a lot of us, at least, that have been in the industry for a while.
Yeah, for sure. The people I find who are successful in security, and it doesn't matter what kind of role they're in, actually, whether they're a defender, an incident responder, a pen tester, a hacker, whatever, there are some common traits in terms of them being happy and successful in the industry. Things like continuously being curious, like continuously wanting to learn, being able to communicate is a big one, both written and verbal, thinking somewhat in an organized kind of way, in a structured kind of way, helps with a lot of it, but also thinking very broadly. So there are some folks that can go very technically deep because of the way they think, and there are some people who can go strategically very broadly because of the way they think. But in all cases, they're able to take bits of information and put them together in such a way that they are adding value to the organization, in either in terms of the kinds of technology being used or the kinds of business processes that need to be completed. Because security isn't just about the tech, it's also about how the business works, right? So, you know, when I started at Ohio State, we had a lot of people clicking on phish. Well, one of the reasons they click on phish is because their business process requires them to use email with attachments. When your business process requires emails with attachments, you are conditioned to click. So it did me no good going in as a CISO and saying, don't click on stuff, because they were being paid to click on stuff. So you need people in security who can go, here are the technical controls around email, but here are the business controls around email as well. Here's the process. Here's the people, the psychology component. Some of my best employees came from non-technology backgrounds, like music. Music people, for some reason, are like hugely up there all the time. People who like board games, I don't know what it is, but they're really great at security. Find me someone who did D&D in the 80s. I'll find you a really great security person. Yeah, so we need these really broad ways of thinking, and they're not all people who've got a computer science or a math degree. They can be, but they don't have to be.
I had a public administration degree from Miami University, and as my career has progressed, I've really stayed focused in the governance and the policy and all of that craziness. It wouldn't do well if I was watching a log feed and defending someone, but you know, I'm in that same spot where you're, why are we doing the process instead of how do we protect the process? And so
that's it requires
that kind of people too.
That's right.
You referenced your entry into computers. I think it was in high school, the Commodore 64. And my sophomore year at Miami was the first time they had a computer science class. So certainly not information security classes that back then the computer people were developers and engineers and network people, and as much as you networked anything. Now we have all these programs coming out. A high school student, a young kid thinking about, you know, where do I go? Is it just to focus on a cybersecurity degree, or is that broader focus going to be more useful for them and to do something else as well?
If someone's starting in at the high school or even the middle school level, I would, even if their ultimate goal is not to be a tech nerd, I would still have them do tech classes, because there is still a tech component to security. As much as we go and say there's something for everyone, and there is, you've got to be comfortable with tech. You don't have to be an expert, but you have to sort of know how things, how people are thinking.
At least the context of what you're working in, absolutely.
That's right. So what I see in Ohio, for example, is a number of middle school classes that deal with things like math, for sure. Not that you have to be great at math to be great at security, but it doesn't hurt. Robotics can be another one. There are summer camps that introduce students in a very gentle way to concepts of being a good digital citizen. How do you live in a digital world, in an online world? How do you do that in a safe and secure way? I think there are age-appropriate elementary school things like that. In high school, yep, math for sure. I would do some kind of civics class, because a lot of what we do in security is based on how our government works. So that's important. I do, if they've got a computer science class. Now, code.org did a national survey, and the last report I looked at, Ohio had only 42% of high school schools were offering at least one computer science class, which is not great, right? But if you have access, we're trying to change it. But if we have access to a computer science class, take it. That's enough. It doesn't have to be an AP class, but just at least some level of computer science class would be super useful. So I think there are things like that, that if you're already starting out in high school, you can take those things. They're usually free to you. They're usually age appropriate, and see if you like it or not. It doesn't mean that later on in your adult life you can't come back to security if things change, because things change. But if you're in high school and you're thinking this might be a thing, that would be those. That's where I'd start.
So fast forward a bit to college. You know, the courses there, when I started in security, which would have been building web pages and realizing that people were going to try to do bad things to them, is my start, and that was in the late 90s. There really wasn't a security discipline per se. You did security things, but we didn't have any structure. You referenced that the industry is new and has some unique characteristics to it. Maybe speak to that here first.
Yeah.
What's unique about the security industry and the profession?
Well, I think there's a few things. I think we aren't at a point where there is a structured understanding of what it means to be security or do security. So actually, there's some proposals going through in England right now for them to set up like a licensing structure for cybersecurity in the same way that accounting or law or other professional organizations have. And I'll be interested to see where that goes. But right now, that kind of structure doesn't exist. So you can't, if you took 10 security people and put them in a room and said, what do they want in a college program? You're going to get 10 different answers, which makes it really super hard for academics in the college environment to know what they should be offering in terms of classes. What that also means is every community college, every four-year college that offers a cyber program offers something that looks different from somebody else. So it's not, there's no consistency in terms of training. But there's also still at the moment not a lot of consistency in terms of what is done. So we might say something like vulnerability management is a common function in information security teams. It's a very sort of jacks for openers foundational element of most security programs to do vulnerability management. Super important, but everybody does it differently. So from JP Morgan to Ohio State to GBQ to, you know, to startup in Silicon Valley, everyone's doing it in a different way. They're doing it differently technically, and they're doing it differently from a governance perspective. So it's really hard if you're looking for a four-year program to say, well, what kind of four-year program should I go to? Which college is better for me or has a good program? It's really hard to judge that, which means it's still changing a lot. So things aren't the same in every security team. So yes, there's a lot of job hopping from company to company, but it also means the person has to be pretty flexible in saying, I did vulnerability management over here and now I'm going doing it over there. Oh, look, it's different. I'm going to have to adjust. So there's a lot of adjustment still goes on. With that, there's actually a fair amount of stress, right? There's still this, you're still in a learning curve, which is stressful. It can be positively stressful, but it's nonetheless still stressful getting used to going into a new organization and doing something that you thought you knew that you didn't really know. So there's things like that. The other thing is there's still a big misunderstanding about what security can be in terms of company leadership. So I think sometimes I have debates with my colleagues, is it better to do security for a technology company because arguably people might know what you're doing, or is it better to do security for a company that their core business has nothing to do with technology and the owners and leaders of the company don't really know what you do? In both cases, you're dealing with people who don't know what you do. Technologists who think they understand what it's like to be a security person don't typically, but they think they do. So that could be even worse sometimes. So there are things like that that go along with being in the industry that I don't think we've wrapped our arms around yet in terms of how to manage it really well. So right now there is a high burn and churn rate for security people because it's quite stressful.
Well, I think to add to the stress, you often feel like you're fighting something you can't win, that
yes,
there's so much going on. And, you know, typically, mostly you mentioned vulnerability management, you're never going to get rid of all the vulnerabilities.
No.
So you have to figure out, what am I going to do? Focus just on criticals, highs and criticals. I'm in an environment where that's not acceptable. I have to get rid of all the mediums. Mm-hmm. But you know, technology changes every month or week or day. And at some point, I can't push the ocean back with the broom kind of a mentality.
Sometimes I think I'm starting to see things, ways of thinking about that, ways of dealing with that, that will make it easier in the long run. I think there is an acceptance that you can't get rid of all the vulnerabilities. So how do you risk manage what you have? And then from a technical perspective, rather than trying to keep patching, just have a clean image and blow the old image out, put the new image in, rather than just trying to modify what you have. Mm-hmm. Works really well in a cloud native environment, not so well in a real legacy environment that's got a lot of old stuff that you can't touch. So it's going to vary by industry, by technology stack. But I think there are things that are coming that will help, but we're not there yet. You're right. Absolutely. Not there yet.
So the way you structured the book, you mentioned that it could have been three. Getting into security, living in security, leading in security. We've touched really areas of that are spread throughout those three, three different books. But I could see the educator when we're talking about those that are arriving in security. First, you do the, here's some other things to read throughout the book, which is really tremendous. And sitting here in Columbus, you talk about getting involved in, you don't mention Columbus because the book has a much broader audience, but the Columbus security community is, there's ISC Squared, there's CISA, there's ISACA, there's a group organized around FAIR, which is a risk management methodology, with tremendous networks.
Yeah.
And sometimes people with a technical bent aren't the same kind of folks to go and do the networking things. So that, because I think it's very important to build a network. Oftentimes, in my experience, security feels like a club you can't get into unless you're in the club. And that's not true if you network.
That's true. So one of the things I talk about in the book all the way through from breaking into security to leading a team is using networks as a support mechanism primarily. But yeah, you're right. So first of all, in Columbus, in Ohio, there are a lot of communities of practice that you can join whether you're in the practice or not, right? You can start there. It doesn't mean that you've got to go and be an extrovert. There are also online communities that you can learn. And one of the silver linings of COVID is we're doing a much better job of being an online community than we used to. So, you know, I think even where we used to have, you know, the huge ISSA conference every year and you'd have to show up in person, now you can be hybrid if you want to. There are ways of getting involved in those kinds of things. I think there are things like Reddit threads, GitHub threads, other places like that where you can get involved without having to be physically present, if that's how it floats your boat. But in all cases, I think there's learning to be had from that broader community. We are all doing different things in different ways. And if you don't expose yourself to that, you're going to get left behind. And so it is a part of the job. If you want to be in the industry, you've got to be able to get out there and network, either virtually or in person.
I was on the local board for CSA, and the COVID just killed us because it was meet at a bar. And in fact, once Ohio State brought a lab and we did a capture the flag event, drink a beer, try to break a city is essentially what the exercise was. And all that went away. And so now they've gone as an international organization, much more virtual. And I know locally, Columbus has a very well-known information security summit, and they've gone virtual the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And those are obviously ways to participate. And if you're more comfortable in the keyboard, you're right, Reddit and GitHub and those places are prolific with good advice. And then LinkedIn as well. There's a number of practitioners that are out there. That's a great way to build your network with clicks.
Yep.
So you speak in the book. I always think about the different personalities in security, the difference between a pen tester, who I call a breaker, and a security manager who tends to be a little bit more of a compliant personality. Mm-hmm. But you speak to personas, and there's a role for every persona in security. Can you speak to that a little bit, the four personas?
So first of all, I will tell you, there's no scientific basis behind these personas. These are just things that I've observed over my career. And I'm sure people can come up with some other ones. But one of the things I talk about in the book is, if you're going to be successful in security, you've got to know why you're there. You've got to know what it is about security that draws you in, and you've got to know what it is about yourself that makes you stay. And so what I tried to do in the book was give some examples of where I see types of people or groupings of people that tend to seem to be sticky in terms of coming and staying. So, for example, I talk about the protector as a sort of a persona. And a protector is someone who comes in and says, I like security because I think it serves the purpose of protecting us. Now, us could be an individual or a company or a state or a nation, but there is this service component to it. Often those folks come out of the military or the Peace Corps or some kind of bigger than themselves kind of organization, right? And I see a lot of that. And we see a lot of that, though, you know, those kinds of folks tend to go into these defensive kinds of roles. So they'll be a SOC analyst, or I actually think of pen testing as defensive too. That they'll go and test controls to make sure that controls are working as appropriate. There's a lot that they will do there. So that's one. Another one is, and I've talked about this before, is I call it the puzzler. These are the people who are intellectually curious. They like doing jigsaw puzzles. They like building Lego models. They do Dungeons and Dragons. They're board gamers. You know, those kinds of folks. They do the crossword puzzle in the paper. They're intellectually curious about how stuff works, how things fit together, how the business processes flow. Those kinds of people, I call them puzzlers. And again, they're really great in analytic kind of roles, right? That could be, again, pen testing, but it could also be a governance, risk and compliance kind of role where they're trying to work out how the business process interacts with a security policy. It could be any of those things. So puzzlers is another. The third I put in as change agents. So we've talked about this already, that the industry is changing all the time. Technology is changing all the time. The risk profiles of our technology always changing. And so people who like change and making change do really well in security. People who get bored easily doing the same thing over and over do really well in security because you hardly ever get bored. Like, really, it's always happening. And then the fourth one was what I called the moral crusader. And this ties back a little bit to that protector role, but it's more about what's ethical. And in the security space, there's a lot of overlap with things like privacy, data governance, those kinds of functions. And those kinds of people, and I think some of us have all of these personas in us. I guess the question is, can you identify strongly with one or another? For me, I identify with the moral crusader a lot because there's a lot going on in technology, and the role security plays that raises ethical questions. Think, just follow the NSO conversation that's going on at the moment, right? So we've got technologies that can be used to surveil people. We use those same kinds of technologies to protect people, but they can be used badly. So where is the line? Where do we stop? Where is it appropriate to do surveillance? And you get into questions like, should there be backdoors in encryption, FBI and other law enforcement agencies, right? So when do we need to be able to break our own systems to protect child trafficking victims? And when do we need to put a hard stop so that we can protect everybody, but knowing that we're going to be leaving a certain group or a certain kind of data behind? Like, those kinds of questions come up in this moral crusader group. It's huge.
Well, and the issue with privacy, which we won't turn this into a privacy conversation. Well, first off, that's why people that do tabletop and Dungeons and Dragons do this, because this stuff sometimes is just a big head game.
Yes.
But, you know, it used to be the industry was about keeping the bad guy out. And now a lot of these moral questions, you know, I can do this with genetic code, but then should I do this with genetic code? Or I know this about these people. You're right. I can protect somebody with it, but it's also the flip of it. You know, when you get into healthcare and other kind of information, it can be real dangerous. It can be wielded as a weapon if it's not handled correctly.
Right. Yes. So, you know, we talk about that. And when I talk about that with students or the people that I'm mentoring, they'll go, oh, I hadn't thought about it through that lens, but that speaks to me. And then when that happens, now they've got a way of taking this huge industry and focusing down a little bit more on pieces of the industry that's really going to, you know, work on that particular why for them, which can be a useful way of like pinpointing how do you do security? What do you want to do in security?
Well, I think I'll use that in the future, because I can tag the kind of personalities that match with the consulting world versus being in an organization. You know, our perspective is we protect a lot of different organizations. So there's a little bit of all that persona in what we do, but there's some predominant roles in consulting. So that's actually a really helpful model. Mm-hmm. You speak about the stress, and we talked about that a little bit earlier, mm-hmm. but the new technology, just the explosion, it's not the, since Doug and Helen encountered Radio Shack and what it was, a TRS-80 and the Commodore 64. TRS-80 was when I was in high school. And then, you know, not having a computer science program until sophomore year of college, all that new stuff. Mm-hmm. When I started at GBQ, when they acquired my firm 5 years ago, very few clients were in the cloud. Now, mm-hmm. we could talk forever what that really means. But if we just isolate the Microsoft 365 product, mm-hmm. very few people were on Microsoft 365. And now, particularly accelerated by the pandemic, mm-hmm. everywhere. You've got now, a lot of times when we do assessments, we're finding high percentages of what's on the network being information of things, IoT devices, mm-hmm. Safety systems, HVAC, stuff that people don't even know is there. Mm-hmm. How do you keep up with that?
It's difficult. So again, I go back to, you're going to be successful in security if you have a curiosity mindset. If you like things to be stable and change free, this is not the industry for you. In the book, I talk about a few things. I think, again, networking is really important. I can't tell you that there's a lot going on right now that I'm trying to wrap my head around. Quantum encryption, blockchain, certainly cloud, but within the cloud, you know, things like containerized security. You're right, IoT security is a thing. I can't know in depth all those things. So what I have to be able to do is at least get myself to the point where I'm comfortable understanding the basics of it. And then as need arises, I can go deeper depending on what the topic of the day is or the thing I'm trying to do for that day is. So I think, you know, using things like podcasts and blogs and social media like LinkedIn and Twitter and others can be great sources of information about where to get resources on these things. And taking advantage of those as part of your work week is a really important thing to do. So, for example, I walk the dog every day. It's one of the benefits of being at home now is I can walk the dog every day. But when I do, I'm listening to a podcast about a thing. It could be about IoT. It could be about quantum. It could be about whatever. Am I now an expert? Absolutely not. But when someone comes to me and says, Helen, I've got this concern about blockchain security, I at least know where to start, right? So it takes down my anxiety level that something's happening out in the world that I should know about that I don't, which is a big problem in cyber. So there's the how do I sort of stay in touch with emerging thought is one piece. And then you've got the networking piece. So if you want to go deep, you can. So right now I can reach out. I've got a great friend in Brent Houston. He knows a lot about blockchain. I networked with him through an ISSA conference, I think, which is where I first was introduced to Brent. And now I am in a position where he comes to me if he's got a question about something I know that he knows less about. There's not a lot of that, by the way. And then I can go to him and say, hey, Brent, what are you hearing about this or that? And he'll give me resources too, right? So the networking doesn't have to be I'm now part of a group of people who are all interested in Bitcoin. It can be I found a person who knows a thing about this thing, and when I have a question, I can go and ask. That's how I manage those kinds of things. Now, occasionally my job as a CISO or an advisory CISO will drag me deep into a topic. And that's fine. That's part of the job. And I'm going to spend time on the job doing that kind of learning. But that's how I have to do it.
Yeah, I know Brent, and I would imagine the conversation with Brent can drag you deep into a topic.
Yes, but it's always interesting.
In a good way. I mean, in a good way.
Absolutely.
So, you know, you mentioned the imposter syndrome. And is that part of what contributes to it? Because I can know a little bit about blockchain, but it seems like it's such a bigger topic. So I'm not an expert in everything I feel like I need to be an expert in.
Yes. So imposter syndrome is an interesting thing. I think Harvard Business Review came out with an article that says, stop telling women they've got imposter syndrome. There's a couple of things going on with the term imposter syndrome. And the way I would characterize imposter syndrome is when you show up for work or in a networking situation or whatever, and you doubt whether or not you should be there. That's sort of my highest level definition of imposter syndrome. I think all of us, regardless of who we are, deal with imposter syndrome at some point or another. And I think in the cybersecurity realm, this issue of there is so much to know, the field is so broad, the technology is changing, is a cause for imposter syndrome for all of us. I think the thing about imposter syndrome, though, is if you are in any way not part of the majority, you're female in a male space, you're black in a white space, you're LGBTQ in a hetero space, whatever that is, when you're in that minority group, it's much more common to experience that imposter syndrome, and it makes it harder to work. So I talk about that in the book, and I talk about how to perhaps, again, guess what? Networking is a great way of helping to both see when that's real and when that's not real and understand how to deal with it. But yeah, imposter syndrome is certainly a thing in cyber. And if you fall into the rabbit hole of social media, Twitter in particular, there are a lot of quote unquote cybersecurity rock stars. I hate the term, but you get the idea. People who are very prominent in the cybersecurity industry, and they've done amazing things. They're prominent for a reason. They're typically not just social media influencers, that they've got the work behind them to prove it. But it can be quite intimidating to look at what they've done and go, who am I to be sitting here and talking about? Who am I to give a talk at a conference? Who am I to do a blog about this topic? The reality is we need all the voices. So I'm a big advocate too for saying, don't let that kind of shiny rock star thing drag you down, because they get imposter syndrome too.
Well, I know from speaking, and that you probably get this as well, that there's always one person who loves you and think you're the smartest human being they ever encountered. And then their evil twin is always on the surveys and thinks you're the dumbest thing that they've ever encountered and wonder really how you get up in the morning and breathe. And then everybody in between. And I find that the everybody in between questions and even challenges in a speaking engagement, if you can take the risk of doing those things, helps you grow, and it kind of cuts that imposter syndrome down. But I've encountered that with employees in the past, that they just don't feel they know enough. we encounter it with clients where, well, I'd like to do the assessment today, but I have just a few more things I want to get done. Mm-hmm. You're always going to find things in an assessment that need to be corrected. That's a control. That's part of the process.
But I
find that personality a lot. You mentioned the different communities and how that maybe magnifies or accelerates mm-hmm. this. Lawrence Jones, who I spoke with, I think he was one of the first of the podcasts. We talked quite a bit about people of color in the industry. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we joke about the Dungeons and Dragons thing, but, you know, the preponderance of I'm 57 year olds who played Dungeons and Dragons in high school. That's a community. And there are a lot of 57 year olds who played Dungeons and Dragons in high school that aren't, you know, haven't settled in a career yet. So it's younger people that we need to get to, particularly younger people in other communities. You know, speak to that, I guess, first from you're from a diverse community and you want to get into this. How do you do it? Is it the same network, you know, learn, broaden yourself? Any other advice in that space? Because I know you've got a passion for that.
Yeah, I do. I think the how do you get there is the same for someone who is in a minority group than others. I think I'm reluctant to suggest something that would obligate them to do something more. It's hard enough as it is, right?
Agree. I totally agree.
But there are networking groups for diverse organizations. There are women in technology groups. There are the International Cybersecurity Community. They just changed their name. I'm going to get it wrong. It used to be the International Cybersecurity for Minorities, which covered women and Black people and basically anybody who wasn't white. Or, you know, there are those groups that are out there. So I think if you're of that group and you're finding that being a minority is challenging, because it's not challenging for everybody, right? But if you're finding that it is, then there are groups like that that I think you can reach out to for support and for sense checking. Sometimes it's really easy to go, I didn't get that job because I'm female or I'm this or I'm that. And sometimes that's true. Sometimes that's not true. So having a community around you that you trust that can help you sort through the signal and the noise can be really useful. But I think the path of do you do a degree? Do you do a boot camp? Do you do a two-year degree or a four-year degree? How do you get an internship? All of those things I think are true whether you're a minority or not. And I think one of the things that's really hopeful for me is right now there are a lot of companies and hiring managers who are really sensitive to that, which if you went back 10 years ago, they weren't as sensitive to that. So I think the opportunity for a minority to get into cybersecurity is really good right now. So take advantage of it.
Well, we won't get to the sensitivity portion of it and the time periods when we weren't. But from my perspective, it's just a math problem. We don't have enough people sitting in the security jobs. We talked earlier about whether it's because the hiring managers can't find the right people or because there aren't enough people. But mm-hmm. at the end of the day, that door's got to be a lot broader and a lot more open for us to be able to staff positions that – again, have global implications, even though you don't think about it when you're protecting your company here in Columbus, Ohio. What's happening in Europe today could affect your business tomorrow.
And, absolutely. You
know, we need those people to be able to come in and sit down and broaden. And so to broaden the door and keep it open is a simple math problem. You know, forget the sensitivity, not to make it simplified because it elicits a lot of passion for a lot of people, but if we don't open the doors to the industry, we're not going to have enough people to do the work.
It's true. So here's my two cents on this. I think in terms of entry-level jobs, and there is an argument in the industry about whether cybersecurity can have entry-level jobs. Like there's an assumption of some kind of tech experience or something, probably true. But I'm going to use air quotes. For entry-level jobs, there's actually a lot of candidates for entry-level jobs. We've got a lot of people coming out of high school now and two-year college and four-year college, and there aren't as many entry-level jobs as you would think. You don't take an entry-level person and make them the only security person in your organization, right? If you can only have one or two or three resources, you want one or two or three resources who've been around the block a couple of times. Once they're in place, maybe then you get an entry-level job, but I think students are sometimes surprised because they think they're going to roll out of college and get a job like that. And some of them can, but a lot of them can't because those jobs are highly competitive. You get into 5, 10, 15 years experience, sort of that in the window, and it's really hard to find candidates like that. There is certainly a salary race going on, so some people can't afford those resources. But there are a ton of people that I speak to who are themselves in it 5, 10 years into their career, not security career, something else, who want to get into security, and they're really struggling to find that lateral move over. How do they go from being a project manager in tech to being a security person? How do they go from being a business analyst to being a security person? How do they go from being a music teacher to being a security person? Like, they've already got 5 or 10 years. They're not going to go back and do an entry-level cyber job. They've got to be able to move over into, maybe not a senior-level cyber job, but they've got to be able to move into those middle-level roles. And that's a really hard path at the moment because you've already got a job. You're not going to quit your job and do a 4-year degree. So is it a boot camp? Is it online learning? How do you get an internship? How do you get the experience so that you can be hireable, employable as a mid-career person in security if you didn't start in security? That's where we've got a lot of the gaps. And that's where, as hiring managers, we need to be able to say, look at the work experience this person has. Look at the business experience they have. I can teach them the security stuff on the job, but I'm going to hire them for their non-security experience and make them a security person. That's how we're going to fill the gaps. And we don't do a great job of that right now.
Well, and that's the big question. When I was reading the book, it was, you've got the 3 different books in one book kind of approach. And I think there's a fourth one from my standpoint, and that's the chief operating officer, the CFO, who says, this person's doing pretty well. Can they be my security person? And I hear, absolutely, given the right mix of talent and skills and desire and ambition, what you refer to as your why, given the right why, somebody can make that move. We have a person on our team right now who spent quite a bit of time in a healthcare clinical environment. He knows HIPAA from the standpoint of it getting in the way of him doing his job. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to that. If the job process is wrong, then maybe fix the job process instead of worrying about fixing something else. So it's absolutely possible. What would you say to the executives who's thinking about moving somebody, about how to support them in that transition?
Yeah. So first of all, I think that the core of the problem is that we have historically hired people based on their experience and not their potential. And we've got to flip that. We've got to start hiring people based on their potential to do security, not because they've done security. So that's the first thing I would say. Once you identify what those skills are, maybe it is business experience, like your example that you have, or project management experience, you've got to be intentional about, well, what is it about security? We hire a lot of people into security, but we don't have them do security jobs. We're having them be business analysts or project managers or software developers who also happen to do the security piece. So I think we've got to be intentional about saying, what is security about this job, and what is generically other stuff about this job, and then provide the training for that security stuff. Do you, as part of their onboarding, do you send them off to a boot camp? Is it worth bringing somebody in at a lower salary and spending $5,000 on a SANS boot camp for a week to jumpstart them into the security space? Well, yeah, probably it is, actually. So what are the opportunities there? If you're offering tuition reimbursement, are there local programs that are close by that you can sponsor them to do that program at a community college, at a 4-year college, at a boot camp, whatever, as part of their job? And, oh, by the way, give them time on the job to do that work, right? So it's not, hey, come do this job and we're sending you to night school. It's come do this job and we're going to give you 10 hours out of your week to do classwork while you're learning on the job. Like, there are those kinds of things that I think we need to get better at. But it starts with identifying the person for their potential, not based on just their experience.
As I talk to people with Empower Hour recordings, the word capacity continues to come up. And, you know, we have had more retirees than we expected. We have had people that have exited different jobs. There are open jobs, and that as a business community, not just information security community, we need to think about how do we expand capacity. And that's exactly that flip. Look for potential and raise them up, elevate them, as opposed to, well, you don't have the experience, I'm not going to hire you.
That's right. That's right. Now, I recognize when you do that, the time to get value out of that employee is longer. But what I'm seeing is people sitting with a whole bunch of open job recs that they never fill. That would be just as, that time period would be just as long. If you've got recs open for 6 months, you've got a problem, right? So we've got to flip our thinking in terms of hiring. So in the book, I've got a, for the breaking in piece, I've got a, this is how you write your resume. For the, I'm now going to be a manager of a team, I've got, this is how you write a job description, right? And for the leading the security team piece, I've got a piece that says, how do you keep the talent you've got? How do you build a diverse team? How do you keep it? How do you grow it? So there are elements that all of those three things have to be in alignment, right? You've got to have a candidate who can sell themselves. You've got to have a hiring manager who knows what they need. And you've got to have a leadership team who are willing to invest in people. And if you don't have those three things, there's going to be breakdowns regardless.
So the last chapter of the book, really in the section that talks about, you know, leading security, you speak about legacy. And I think, if I remember correctly, you were the first CISO at Ohio State, second CISO at Ohio State, the journalistic accuracy. Anyway, there's a legacy there, but there's a lot of, in the climbing world, first ascents. There's a lot of first ascents still available in this.
Absolutely.
This, so maybe speak a little bit to legacy, and then we'll flow to the final countdown and get about it. Yeah.
So when I was writing the book, I was in the process, I was about 7 years into my role at Ohio State. And when I had started in my role at Ohio State, I thought I'd be there for 3 years. Go figure, organizational change takes longer in higher ed than perhaps in other cultures. Maybe not. But I was there for almost twice as long as I thought I'd be. And it made me reflect on why. And some of it was I had programs that I was still shepherding through that I hadn't completed yet. And the biggest part of it was in my previous role when I was at a Wall Street bank, when I left that team, within about 6 to 12 months, that team had been pulled apart and sent in all kinds of different directions. And I felt badly about that. I felt like I hadn't left enough behind me to make it stick. And I was like, well, damn, if I'm going to, and I was 10 years at that company. So if I'm going to be 8 years a CISO, I don't want 6 months after I'm gone for everything to have fallen apart. Like it shouldn't be about me. I need to have given legs to what I left behind. So for me, having a legacy was within my organization, what remains of me when I'm gone. And it doesn't mean that everything has to stay exactly the same, because of course it won't. But can I look back in the 10 years after I've left and say, because I was there, these things were able to occur? There's a question of legacy around what do you leave for the industry? Now, some people care about that and some people don't. For me, I care about that. So one of the reasons I wrote the book, one of the reasons I continue to teach at Ohio State, one of the reasons I'm continuing to be active in local chapters, security chapters and national ones, is I want to leave a footprint not just on my company, but on the industry. So what does that look like? And more esoterically, you know, when I retire for good, which hasn't happened yet, or, you know, I could go way out there. When people are talking about me at my funeral, what do I want them to say, right, about this? We spend a lot of time at work. Like, yeah, there's all the, I want to be a good mom and a good wife and a sister and a daughter. And I want all those things. And if I've spent, you know, 2/3 of my life in my professional capacity, I want them to say something good about that too. So these were all the things that I sort of chewed on as I thought about what my legacy was. And a lot of the questions that came up for me in my mentoring was, what do I do after I'm a CISO? What's next? And I will tell you, I've learned a lot in the last year that isn't in the book. So if I do a revised version of the book sometime in the future, I'm going to blow this out a little bit more. There is life after being a CISO. Some people think being a CISO is like the final stop in your security career. It's like the top of the organizational career ladder. It's not. So I think there's some benefit to saying, what do I want my end state to be? And maybe for some people it's the CISO, maybe for some people it's not. And that's great. But that's what I talk about in the book. And my answer to those questions keeps changing every year.
Well, the security industry is unique, but that advice is not unique to the security industry. If you read writing your personal mission statement and a lot of that kind of material, it always says start with the end. What are they going to say at my funeral? And right. You're right, we've all got many roles to play in life, and it's not just about the job. So that's great life advice, not just great security career advice. Reading a book about somebody that you know a little bit about, you always learn something new. And I'm shocked that you're not my first Buckeye, but you're my first Australian, that you don't like bagpipes. I love them. I love them, but they're Amazing Grace is my favorite song on the bagpipes, but it's probably like fingernails on the chalkboard to you.
Yes.
So, with the intent to learn five more things about you, a final countdown, we close every Empower Hour with five questions. So I'm going to just shoot them off. What did you dream of becoming when you were in middle school?
Something to do with gardening. So probably landscape architect, actually.
Who inspires you?
I'm going to be really hokey, and I'm going to say that the entire security community inspires me. There is a lot of amazing people and a lot of amazing work, and it gets me out of bed every day.
We are going to give most hokey awards for all of these. It's been interesting. Nobody gives this the pat answer you expect. So you can be as hokey as you want. What is your favorite life hack?
At the moment, time blocking has been the thing that's keeping me going. I am super active on social media, but I admit to getting dragged into social media rabbit holes, and that caused me to multitask, and that caused my brain to fracture, and that caused me to be not particularly productive. So blocking time off my calendar where I turn off all my gadgets. I am very focused in the morning. I am most energized in the morning. I'm sorry to tell a lot of security people I am a morning person. So I time block in the morning. I probably get more done in the first 3 hours of the day typically than the rest of my week combined. So time blocking is my thing at the moment.
What has been your most valuable failure?
Staying too long in an organization, I think. I fall in love with the people that I work with. I typically fall in love with the companies I work with, the things that I'm doing. And it takes me a little while to realize that my value in that role declines over time. Like it peaks and then it declines and I stay too long. So I've learned my lesson. I won't do that again.
And then you work hard. How do you balance life?
I have a super supportive family structure. The fact that I moved halfway around the planet to live in Ohio after having family in Australia is not indicative of how much I rely on my family. So my immediate family here in Ohio, my husband, my daughter, but my extended family all over the globe, they are everywhere, keeps me grounded and keeps me sane. And that's my jam, family for sure.
Great answer. So if you're thinking about security as a career, you're in it and want to improve your lot in security, you're beginning to lead, or you're in the middle of a leadership role and you're thinking about it, the book's a great book, but it's more of a jumping off point, because I think splashed in that educational community, there's a lot of go read this, and I suggest you look at that kind of advice as well. Mm-hmm. Grab the book, move from that standpoint to wherever your career takes you, celebrate it, and then also finally link with Helen on LinkedIn, because I find that her conversations that she starts are extremely valuable and part of my networking. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Doug. It's been great to be here.
Time's up. Thanks for listening to this episode of Empower Hour. Join us next time by subscribing to Empower Hour on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or your preferred listening platform. Want more GBQ? We don't blame you. Visit us online at gbq.com for the business news and advice that matters most. Who is empowering your growth?